That is Veronica and a child. Yeah.
So I'm going to start while they're coming up. So the St. Warburg's Clinic, Maria already kind of gave a good background to it, so I'm just going to go through the pictures quickly. But one of the points of it, you can just keep going through them. One of the points of the photos when we get to it was Andre, Cliff Walker's son, was able to join us. And so it was great to have a different generation there to see this. And so the chief was very tickled. He's a very kind of spunky man. And this is a picture of Andre and Chief Chigador's Munia dancing. And the chief pulled him out and said, Andre, we have to dance together. Because you're going to carry on the tradition of your grandfather. And so it was a very powerful moment, and Andre couldn't be here today, so I just wanted to share kind of his piece and one of his big memories with you. John?
Good morning, Mayor Potter and commissioners. I'm John Motter. I've been living positively with HIV for at least 11 years, and having spent half of the last 24 months volunteering in rural Western Kenya, I thought I would be prepared for what I would see in Zimbabwe, and I could not have been farther from being prepared than anyone could imagine. I was continually astounded by the lack of resources in a country that has an estimated 30% HIV infection rate, but I was even more amazed by the amount of blind faith that is held by people who, in my opinion, have no concrete reasons to have hope. And I think this goes back to what Maria said in terms of hope just being vital to living. FASO is meant to provide testing for HIV, HIV medication, counseling services, nutritional therapy, and courses, as well as income-generating projects such as the embroidery. In reality, they're no longer able to provide many of these services because of lack of funding. But what they lack in services, they definitely make up for in the amount of love and support that goes on between all the members of the organization. As part of our day at FASO, we had the opportunity to move from group to group and ask them what they wanted the people of Portland to know about their life. And it was painful to hear the responses. Although the government supposedly provides free HIV medication, in order to get that medication, a patient has to go to the Mutare Infectious Disease Hospital every 3 months and pay for their own lab work. And because of the financial problems that Dana's pointed out, it makes it impossible. And so in reality, people just are not on any HIV medication that could prolong their life. The other thing that was surprising was that tuberculosis, when I asked people about how many of them had tuberculosis, every single group, roughly 70 to 80% of the people said they either currently have tuberculosis or have had it at one time. Many of the people have been on it more than once. They're unable to complete the treatment regimen, or they just become reinfected because of the closeness they live and with other people. Tuberculosis is a disease of poverty. People that are living, you know, 5 to 6 people in a very small room tend to pass tuberculosis on fairly easily. Co-infection with HIV and TB severely affects the life expectancy in Zimbabwe. It's currently at about 42 years, which is roughly half of what we are able to enjoy here in the United States. A woman took great pride in showing us the garden. And as you can see in the picture, the space is really quite large, but there's very few plants. It's phenomenal that what they do plant are herbs and greens that boost the immune system or reduce side effects of HIV, such as nausea. The problem is that there's no longer seeds available, and there's a water shortage, so they're unable to really grow as much as they need. But you know, in looking at the garden, it's also important to bring up the amount of food people have available to eat. And In speaking with them, they roughly have about a fistful size of rice a day and half a fistful of beans, if they're lucky. And many times the mothers are giving their portion of food to their children so that their children have enough food to eat. And these are mothers that are suffering from wasting due to HIV and AIDS, and yet they're still giving up their food to provide for their children. I know that sharing my story inspired and empowered the people at FASO, the people at St. Werburgh's, but I have to say that I really did get the better end of the stick. You know, the entire time was really emotionally difficult for me. As a person being fortunate enough to live in a country where I can get proper care and proper medication, to hear the stories of these people and yet see the amount of hope that they maintain was incredibly empowering to me and expanded my horizons into being even more grateful for what I have and the support my family has. So, you know, as you can tell, it's emotional need for even to share the experience, but it was absolutely wonderful to be there.
Sup? I'm Trey Ford. I'm a junior in Grant High School. Really going here, I thought, you know, I was going to go and change people's lives, which, I mean, I did, but I think they changed our lives more than we changed theirs. Especially being at FASO was definitely where I had the most life-changing experience. Dancing with the kids was actually unbelievable. I've done African dance for quite some time, and it's been one of my passions, and just watching these kids and, like, the talent they had in dancing and just the smiles they had doing it. But I think it was one of the biggest things is, like, the people's smiles were just, like, the most radiant smiles as you've ever seen, just glowing, just straight from the heart. They weren't no fake smiles on anyone's faces. This girl was a part of a group called Ichipa, which in Shona means bright light. This was a theater group made of about 7 kids all under the age of 15, who put on a performance for us. And it was just the talent and the soul that these kids had performing just to do it, not for the spotlight or for the fame of, you know, showing people what they can do, but just to have something to do to contain their time. And being a theater kid at Grant High School, I think that changed me the most. I've never seen such a passionate performance as I saw when I was there. And that was just one of the most unbelievable things to see. There was this kid named Winston who was the leader of the group. And his talent with no teaching experience was just unbelievable. They had this book that they kept all their records in themselves. They managed themselves. They had everyone's names, everyone's birthdays, everyone's information about who they were. And after their performance, they did spoken word poetry. And this girl right here at age of 10 had the most beautiful poem and just so much soul and so much heart in her words that she was saying. There was so much meaning in everything that had been said. And I think that was one of the biggest things about being in Zimbabwe is everything was just that everyone had so much hope and had so much faith and everything meant so much to them.
Thank you.
Finally, I need to come back and address kind of a large elephant that I brought into the room, a huge elephant. Near the end of the trip, I went into multiple epileptic seizures that continued throughout several days. In fact, I had about 30 seizures over the course of a few days. And this medical emergency really highlighted the lack of medical care in the country. I was unaware of what was going on because of the seizures, but it created an extreme amount of stress for everyone, both in the delegation, but also everybody on the ground in Mutare as they tried to deal with it. Gasoline had to be siphoned from one car into the ambulance so they could even transport me to the Mutare Infectious Disease Hospital where I was the only patient. I was the only patient mainly because there are no doctors, there is no medicine, so there's no point in really going to the hospital. I was initially put into the ICU room, which you can see in the picture. This is what passes for ICU. It's a room with a burned out light bulb, an empty oxygen tank, and no doctors. Eventually, as the day wore on and it was getting dark, they had to move me into another room so that they could have some light. The one thing that was available from the nurses was tea for the two doctors from our delegation and prayers for me. There simply was nothing else. The mayor's office of Mutare spent hours calling around the country trying to find Dilantin, which is the normal treatment that they would have used on me, and it was simply unavailable. They ended up getting IV Valium and phenobarbital from some of the local pharmacies, and that helped to get me somewhat under control. After one night, the mayor had to arrange to have me transported over into Zimbabwe, or over into Mozambique, so that I could be airlifted to Johannesburg. The reason they couldn't pick me up in Zimbabwe is that two medical evacuation planes that had landed previously had been kept by the Zimbabwe government and not allowed to take off again. So with a $230 bribe, they were able to get me across the border into Mozambique, where I was flown to Johannesburg and spent 3 days in a hospital there before being flown back to OHSU. You know, it all seems so surreal and so foreign to what we experience here in the United States. But, you know, truly without the help of Maria and Mary O'Hearn, things could have really been very tragic by American standards. But I think it's important to note that this is normal, everyday life for people in Zimbabwe, where they're trying to deal with these issues. And the outcome would not have been as good had I been a Zimbabwean. So thank you.
My name is Isabel Riddick, and I am a seventh grader at Oregon Episcopal School. The children I met at FOSO had one or both parents infected by HIV. Many of them had lost a parent or had to help care for a sick parent. The children were physically and mentally very small. For instance, Christine, whose letter I will read, was 17 years old but was only my height. Christine Chikova sent a letter entitled Story of My Life. She is in Form 3, which is a freshman in high school. In her letter, she mentions TB, which stands for tuberculosis. Story of my life. I am a girl aged 17 years. I'm from a family of four children and a mom. There are Blessing 27, Redeemer 24, Tsitsi 21, and myself, Christine. My mother is 47 years. My father passed away in 1997 on the 27th of October. His name was Dominic Chukova. When father died, everything came to an end. My mother had to take care of us, and she became a breadwinner. She crossed borders, especially by Mozambique. By then, she was still strong. Her parents, who stay in Buhera, wanted her to leave us at Kutana Village, where my dad grew up. They declared that if she did not comply, they would not support her. Mom ignored them and took care of us, and her relatives turned her down. Mother got tested in 2004, and she was positive. She did not hide anything from us. We accepted her as the way she was. Blessing got a job, and Mom took a rest for a while. We were renting a house at Dongamvura, and Mother's health started deteriorating. She got TB for the first time, but again, she got it for the second time. This time, Tsitsi also got it, and they were both TB positive. The owner of the house threw us out because she wanted to protect her children since TB is contagious. We slept outside for a few weeks. Then God answered our prayers. Blessing was given accommodation at his workplace, and that is where we are staying. Currently, I am doing Form 3. I want to thank all of you for the support that you have given us. May God continue to bless you always, and may you find happiness wherever you go. And please do not do this only for us, but to everyone that needs your assistance. Greet everyone who did not manage to visit us.
My name is Austin Reglione, and I'm the mayor's chief of staff. And I had the honor of representing the mayor, who was not able to go at the last minute. And I got to be the deputy mayor, which I enjoyed immensely. Actually, I like deputy mayoress the best, but it didn't stick when I came back. I am actually going to be brief because I know we're running late. But I did want to talk briefly about the city of Mutare as a government. This is the Mutare City Hall. This is a delegation in front of the City Hall. We had sent them computers last year. The City of Portland sent 22 desktop and printers that were surplus for us. And this is the Department of Health, and they're all being used, and people were very grateful for them. This is a picture of Simon. He was our host for the City of Mutare. He actually helped us get permission to travel in the country, which was pretty significant given the fact that Jimmy Carter can't get in. He obviously should have met Simon. So while we were there, we had a signing ceremony. The man behind me is the city clerk, the town clerk, like the city manager. The man who is signing with me is actually the mayor of Mutare. And I have to say that he was one of three white people I saw the entire time I was on the trip in Zimbabwe. Just quickly, the city of Mutare has a 19-member city council. They were all recently elected in March. They are all members of the MDC party, which is the opposition party. And they are all black, except for Brian James, who is the mayor. And he was he's a former Rhodesian farmer. He had been beat up. He had his farm taken away from him. He was doused with diesel oil in an attempt to kill him. He did not die. And he was overwhelmingly elected as mayor by his peers on the city council. He is sort of, you know, their own version of a rock star. He's a rising political star in the opposition party. That is us presenting the Portland flag to them. And I'll have to say that we've talked a lot about the perseverance of the people that we met who are hungry and have HIV and are unemployed. But from the city perspective, for you to be mayor and council members and to be in a situation where you cannot provide basic services to your constituents was really rather overwhelming. The mayor expressed to me his embarrassment that there were piles of garbage. They were neat piles of garbage, but they were piles of garbage nonetheless all over the city because they could not get fuel to put in their garbage trucks to pick up the garbage. Like John said, they run the ambulance system, but they don't have any fuel to put in the ambulance. They have three fire trucks, none of which work, and they don't have gas to run them anyway. So these are this is the world in which they live, and they have no money because it's all tied up in the power sharing impasse that's happening at the federal level. So what the mayor of Mutare said that he needed more than anything from the city of Portland was two things. One was their support. The fact that we went there and supported them and acknowledged them was huge to them as a new government trying to, you know, stabilize their community. And secondly, he said what they needed was expertise. They would like to send a delegation to Portland, sometime in the near future with the mayor and a couple of elected officials and some administrators to learn how we, as the city of Portland, run our government so that they can learn efficiencies from us, so that they can go back and run an efficient, effective, service-oriented government. I have talked to Mayor-elect Adams' office about the possibility of me as a volunteer, since I won't be in the mayor's office anymore, being able to work with the Sister City Association, hopefully bringing them back here sometime in 2009 and working with some of our star bureau directors and personnel to help show them some things. The next slide is simply a photograph. This is Cliff Walker and Veronica, who formed the Sister City relationship in 1991, and the man on the right is a former mayor, Msubeki, who attended a reception that was held in our honor. And then the last slide, I just wanted to show you, this is what it was like riding around on the bus. There's piles of suitcases. You can't see the bikes that are in the aisleways. It was very in violation of, I'm sure, every traffic rule in the state. But anyway, we did have a great time. It was a huge honor for me. I had never gone on an international trip before with the mayor. In fact, I've never been anywhere with the mayor. Or traveled for my job, and it was a huge honor to get to represent the city of Portland on this trip. So I thank you very much.
What's the population of Mutare?
It's 200,000.
So in wrapping up, as you can see, it was an amazing group of people, and it was amazing for me to see how our organization has grown in order to be able to take a group like this. And I particularly want to thank you, Mayor Potter, for supporting this and for instigating this, because we have never had an administration, a city administration, since it was founded, be interested in traveling to Zimbabwe. We realize we're one of nine sister cities. We know that. But we're one that happens to be just a humanitarian focus, and so we really appreciate that and your administration for appreciating that or for supporting that. I think, as Dana said, one of the most important things that we did was not bring, 37 pieces of luggage and money, but we brought ourselves. And Meshek Zamba, who is a former teacher at the school as well as the director of the clinic, said to me as he was standing next to me when we arrived, very thin from starving since I have known him, he said, "Oh, Maria, thank you for bringing these people. I can't tell you how much it means to us. It means more than hope, but it means luck. You bring us luck every time you come." So I just wanted to let you know that that people-to-people connection is one of the most important things. And people will frequently say, "Why do you work in Zimbabwe?" You know, as you can hear, it's a difficult country. There's so many other countries you could work in. It'd be so much easier. Why didn't you choose a different country? And I always say, I didn't choose Zimbabwe. Cliff didn't choose Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe chose us. Veronica wrote us, and I think that all the people here will say that Zimbabwe chose them also. So I know you're all sitting there saying, "Well, what can we do, to continue to support you?" And I just want to say to continue to support the effort of the sister cities, because we do some tremendous work in building those bridges across the world. Please visit our website, www.africaaidsresponse.org. And lastly, as you can see, we have our World AIDS Day fundraiser. And this is where we raise the greatest portion of our funds on our trips to support the work that we do there. It will be Monday at the Tiffany Center. It starts at 4 o'clock for the free action fair, as well as Speaker Michael Kaplan from the Cascade AIDS Project. It will be followed by these wonderful youth again giving some more presentations regarding their trips, as well as Loveness Wesa, who will be performing Zimbabwean dance after. And as you can see with the last photo, we have had wonderful stars at our events in the past. This I fondly call the Three Mayors photo, which is from our 2004 event when Mayor Potter was mayor-elect. As you can see on the left in the middle, Bud Clark, actually, who helped support the founding of this sister city, and our future mayor, Sam Adams, who I know will continue to support us and has been at several of our events in the past. So we hope to see you all on Monday, and so appreciate your support and your time today.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. In conjunction with World AIDS Day on Monday, I have a proclamation to read. Whereas December 1st, 2008 is the 20th anniversary of World AIDS Day, and World AIDS Day is the day when individuals and organizations from around the world come together to bring attention to the global AIDS epidemic. And according to the latest data from the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS and the World Health Organization, there are an estimated 38.6 million people living with AIDS worldwide. And there are nearly 7,000 Oregonians currently living with AIDS HIV, and approximately 4,000 of those are residents of the Portland metropolitan area. We share a commitment to mutual support with our sister city, Mutare, Zimbabwe, which is at the epicenter of the AIDS pandemic, and recently sent a City of Portland delegation on a humanitarian mission to Mutare with medical supplies. HIV remains a significant public health problem that requires a strong, sustained, and coordinated international, national, and local strategy. The World AIDS campaign theme for World AIDS Day is in 2008 is Leadership, Keep the Promise, and calls on political leaders to keep their commitment to reach to provide universal access for prevention, treatment, care, and support by 2000. Now, therefore, I, Tom Potter, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City Roses, do hereby proclaim December 1st, 2008, to be World AIDS Day in Portland, and I encourage all residents to observe this day. Thank you for being here today. We really appreciate it. I apologize to the council and to the audience for the length of time. Please read the 10:30 time certain.
Item 1614, accept the 2007-2008 annual report for the Portland Watershed Management Plan.
Commissioner Adams.
Thank you, Mayor, and members of the City Council. Portland has six watersheds, three on the east side, three on the west side. Just to refresh everyone's memory, the Columbia Slough is the watershed that runs along the ridge of the north side of Portland. Just south of it, again on the east side, is the Lost Creeks watershed that runs basically with Burnside and Powell down the middle of it to about 122nd Street. You're going to hear about the Brooklyn Creek Basin Restoration Project, which is in the Lost Creeks watershed. And then south of Lost Creeks in the southern edge of the city is the Johnson Creek watershed. On the west side, we have the West Side Streams watershed that basically runs from Forest Park downtown and south on Barber Boulevard, and then Fano Creek and Tryon Creek watersheds, which are the only two watersheds that don't flow into the Willamette River within the city of Portland. This has been a great year for watersheds, thanks to the support of the members of the City Council and the partnership with the nonprofit community and a lot of support from businesses and the leadership of the team at Bureau of Environmental Services. With Greater Green, we have made this year the largest single commitment to watershed restoration in the history of this city. And in my 3.5 years as the commissioner in charge of Bureau of Environmental Services, I want to thank everyone in the Bureau and both of you and Mary and the whole team for all your great work on this. So today is our annual report to the City Council, and we have Mike Rosen and Dean Merritt. Dean?
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Good morning to members of the council. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. I'm just going to introduce this. We realize that you're running short of time, so we will shorten our report. As Commissioner Adams said, 2 years ago, the City Council adopted the Portland Watershed Management Plan. We've been busy working with all the other bureaus of city government to help implement it. And the good news is that we've been very busy, and the other bureaus have been busy as well, working together. We're very pleased to also indicate that we're working well with the Bureau of Planning as they move forward with the Portland Plan. We have a good working relationship with the Bureau of Planning, and they are integrating the principles of watershed planning into the Portland Plan so that hopefully by the time that process is finished and it comes back to you for adoption of the new Portland Plan, it will embrace fully all of the key principles of sound watershed health. So we're looking forward to that. Before I turn it over to Mike Rosen, who will give you the brief a summary of the report, I want to just acknowledge Matt Berlin, who's sitting right back here. A lot of times you don't get to see the people who do a lot of the heavy lifting and putting together these reports, and I want to thank Matt for his efforts on that regard. Mike?
Thank you. I'm Mike Rosen, and I manage the Watershed Division for the Bureau of Environmental Services, and I will try to make up some time here for you this and give you just a brief overview of what we've done in the last year. This slide I'll go through very quickly. Just as the history of the watershed plan, the resolution 36384 passed the plan in March of 2006, and we're required to come back here annually and report on implementation. As Dean said, we've had an incredibly productive year. Commissioner Adams referred to the Greater Green Initiative. It's been a big boost for our work. So we have a lot of work underway. It's following the plan. It's having an impact. It is the work of the city. It's the work of the citizens of the city and the other bureaus. We have a very strong relationship with the River Renaissance Program and the Bureau of Planning, the Water Bureau, Development Services, PDC, Transportation, Parks, fire, and sustainable development. We would not get our work done without them. I'd also like to acknowledge Matt. He's been great in bringing this report together and really working with the other bureaus and showing that this is a group effort. The emphasis of the report is, again, collaboration and integration of watershed health objectives into the work of the city. So doing the work of the city differently so we can advance watershed health. And again, it's not a single bureau effort. It's all the bureaus and all the citizens working together. We do talk about Greater Green. And finally, I think that one of the other emphasis of the report that's important is this green infrastructure has really taken off this year. It's critical infrastructure, and the city is relying on it for essential city services. What I'll go through fairly quickly is actions, specific actions that we've accomplished or projects that we've completed in the last year. And they fall under six strategy areas that we emphasize to achieve our watershed health goals. In stormwater management, we are emphasizing improving hydrology, and that comes through infiltrating stormwater on site. It allows us to control the volume of stormwater in our system, its velocity, it protects habitat, and it also protects pipe capacity and the life of our gray infrastructure system. A lot has happened this year. We've put in over 300 green streets, almost 400 stormwater facilities on private property. We've turned over 100 feet of ditch that just conveys water into vegetated swales. The project that I want to highlight quickly is Owens Corning, and this is particularly important because this is an area that we have a lot of potential in. It's us working with our industry. Industry typically has a large volume of parking lots and roof area that's impermeable, produces a lot of stormwater. How can we work with them to improve conditions and infiltration? Owens Corning is a Northwest Industrial Roofing Company, and it has a lot of parking surface and roof surface. And we were effectively able to divert that parking lot and roof runoff into vegetated swale. And it really shows that we can do this at industrial sites. We hope to do this at other industrial sites. Many of them are on the river. This gives us an opportunity to send the stormwater back into groundwater and recharge it, cool the water, goes into the river as cool, recharged groundwater, and the fish love it. And we do too. Revegetation is another big area for us. It's all about planting more native plants, removing invasives, and planting trees, and you'll hear more about that later. And that allows us to absorb, capture, and cool stormwater. The project that's been really impressive, and the actions this year, again, over almost 400 acres of invasive species removal, 100 acres of planted with native plants, and over 40,000 trees. We've been working on a very large and ambitious project in the Rocky Buttes natural area. It's multi-partner, multi-year, and really it's to take back an important natural resource area that has been overrun with invasives. We're working with parks, with the Grotto, with State Department of Transportation, Metro, the City Bible Church, and our goal is to recover 150 acres of natural area, remove invasives, and plant natives, and we've gotten a good start. Aquatic and terrestrial habitat enhancement is about repairing degraded natural areas, and that, of course, improves water quality and biodiversity. We've made a lot of gains this year. One of our flagship projects that we just completed is the Stevens Creek Confluence. It is a partnership. This work doesn't happen without partnerships. We're working, again, with parks, with state transportation, Bureau of Transportation, ODF&W, the local neighborhood associations, Friends of Trees, Willamette River Keeper. And we've leveraged quite a bit of money through the Lower Columbia River Estuary Project and grants from the Port and the Nature Conservancy. And this is a significant project because it's part of South Portland Riverbank. And basically what we've done is we removed a decommissioned CSO pipe, combined sewer overflow pipe, and we've restored off-channel habitat, salmon habitat in the lower Willamette. This is one of the key limiting factors for fish in Portland. There aren't a lot of areas like this in the lower Willamette, and any time that we have a chance to recover, enhance one of these areas, it's a big deal for us. And this has been a very successful project. protection and policy. This is all about the most cost-effective way to protect watershed health, which is continuing to invest in changing policies and strategic and leveraged purchases of high-quality habitat. So prevention is the best way to improve watershed health versus restoration. It's very cost-effective. A big focus for us has been the citywide trees project. We have very complex regulations around the city. They're hard to implement. They vary in terms of their approach to preservation and planting of trees. We're working with planning, many of the bureaus and the citizens, to examine and clarify these regulations. This is absolutely critical for us, and I'll talk about this briefly. Greater Green is going to establish or plant 83,000 trees. We need to have the best policies and code in place to preserve this investment. This is a multi-decade investment, and so this is how we're integrating our work into policy.
In fact, later in the item number 1638, we're actually authorizing a contract with the Friends of Trees to move forward that piece of it.
Right, which directly comes out of the Greater Green Initiative. Operations and maintenance, it's not sexy, but it's absolutely important to watershed health improvement, because it's about taking our assets and keeping them in good working order so they protect water quality and habitat functions. The one project I want to highlight is the Portland Public Schools Stormwater Facility Maintenance Project. We have over 30 facilities in schools throughout the city that infiltrate stormwater. So we are managing a lot of stormwater with these properties. We're also creating a great education opportunity for the residents of our neighborhoods and the pupils in these schools. And then finally, we provide a lot of green space through these facilities. A lot of schools, I think we've noticed, there's a lot of blacktop and parking lot, and we're opening up the green environment there. The challenge is that we want to build more of these facilities, and we have to maintain and operate these facilities effectively. So we provided a grant to Portland Public Schools to investigate the most cost-effective way to perform operation and maintenance that provides for long life of the facilities and a cost-effective approach. A lot of times we're integrating the volunteers from the neighborhoods, and there are different ways to do this, and we hope to come up with a strategy recommended by Portland Public Schools that will allow us to continue to build more of these facilities. You've heard a lot about our education and involvement work, and we came here not too long ago and told you about the Community Watershed Stewardship Grant Program, which won a significant award this year from the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Partnership for Campus and Community Collaboration with PSU. And I'll just jump right to the statistics. 13 stewardship grants this year for over $60,000. We've reached 26,000 students through our Clean Rivers Education Program, 40,000 participants in education events throughout the city. And one thing that we're particularly proud of is we're getting a lot of activity, 180,000 hits on our websites. People are coming to the city websites to learn about these systems. And this is a long-term investment, because sustained watershed health is going to come from an engaged and a participatory community. They're taking personal responsibility for watershed health by putting these systems in, and they're making these investments. And that's what that strategy supports. I'm going to close with just two quick overviews of critical programs that have already been briefly mentioned. Brooklyn Creek Basin Program. This is a partnership to do area-wide creative stormwater management in Portland, collaborating with a variety of bureaus and achieving multiple benefits for infrastructure repair and development. We're working with transportation, water, parks, development services, and we have a huge involvement component through the community. We're putting in 600 infiltration facilities. 100 will be put in on private property, so we're working very closely with residents. It's over 2 square miles that we're working on in southwest Portland. It goes from Mount Tabor to the Willamette River, and it runs between Hawthorne and Southeast Powell. The problem is basement flooding, combined sewer capacity, and sewer lines that need repair. And what we're doing differently is instead of just going in and replacing all the pipes, we're replacing the pipes that aren't functioning, but we're taking pipes that are functioning but don't have enough capacity for stormwater, and we're augmenting that capacity with these 600 infiltration facilities, green streets, planters, swales, curb bump outs.
Hey, Mike, while you got that picture up there of this infiltration, that's what you call the planting along the curb?
Yeah.
The curb cut?
Yeah, a bump out.
Okay, so I see, you know, we're doing the same thing on Southwest 5th Avenue here. I see plantings going on, but I'm not seeing any curb cuts that would allow. Is it not allowed?
It's not a swale.
It's not a swale.
No, it's they're planting it with species of plants that don't need to be watered, but they're not swales.
Is that because of the downtown environment or
of other it's in part because of the downtown environment, and by the time we inherited the project, it was too far along on its design. We fought for it, but we weren't successful at it.
So some of the stuff that you're seeing is stuff that we hope in areas of concentrated business and transportation to find those opportunities. But Sam's right. We only got so far on downtown transportation this shot. What I was going to finally just say is it costs $63 million less to do this project by integrating green infrastructure into the gray piped infrastructure. But it's not just about the dollars that we're saving. It's about increasing livability in our communities by adding these amenities. And these amenities add a variety of services that are very important to the city. Livability in terms of quality of life, cooling the city and shading from trees, improving air quality. So what's happening is we're still growing, but we're improving livability. And it comes through the integration of this green infrastructure. So this green infrastructure in a project like Brooklyn Creek Basin is being relied upon to deliver essential city services and functions. We will, by this time next year, have 70 facilities in. In total, I said we'll put in 600 infiltration facilities, more than 4,000 trees. It's a very big deal for us, and it's well underway. And then finally, the Greater Green Initiative, which Sam mentioned, it's an investment of $50 million over the next 5 years, many more acres of eco-roofs, hundreds of green streets, tens of thousands of trees, and you'll hear more about how that's going to happen through contracting later, purchasing lands for protection, putting in culverts, removal of invasives. This works, and that's why we're investing in this kind of infrastructure. And ultimately what we're achieving here is we're increasing the capacity and resilience of our city, not only of the gray infrastructure, but also we're providing important services for cleaner air and water, reduced urban temperatures, better habitat, and a buffer for some of the impacts of global warming.
So by comparison, Commissioner Fish wasn't here. We have, I think, 6 acres of eco roofs right now in the city of Portland. We hope to get to 43 acres.
We have a great team that's working on it. We have projects underway, and we're very excited about what we're doing. And we've hit the ground running, and a lot of it's been from the support of council, Sam, and Lisa Libby. So thank you. And then in closing, we usually close with a fish. This is a rainbow. Oh, wait, I have it the wrong slide. This is a cutthroat trout. It's a 12-inch cutthroat trout from the Schweitzer Restoration Project. And these are the results we're seeing. We are finding fish where we haven't found them before, and we're finding fish in places where people are not expecting to find them. So we're very happy about what we're doing, and we appreciate all your support. Thank you.
Finding fish on the city council, too.
Yeah. Oh, I
know. Some people are still surprised.
We didn't expect that.
Yeah. Some people are still surprised that I'm sitting here. Catch and release. Catch and release.
I think we'll keep this one. We'll be happy to answer any
your
questions.
Your mouth to God's ears. If I could ask a couple of questions. And first of all, gentlemen, it's a superb report, and congratulations on both the work product and on the thinking that's gone behind the strategies. Two particular items of interest to me. One is the challenge of invasive species in Forest Park. There was a news story not long ago saying that it would take probably 100 people 10 years just to tackle the problem. Is that part of your jurisdiction, or is it exclusively a matter of the Parks Bureau to deal with that issue?
I think I'd actually like to defer to Commissioner Adams, who helped organize a summit meeting just recently on invasives.
So last week or the week before, we had our second invasive species summit. The city has hired, as part of the initial work on this, an invasive species czar, Jennifer Goodrich, who established the baseline working with all the bureaus. And what it quantified was the daunting task in front of us, and it is incredibly daunting. Whoever gets the Bureau of Environmental Services will need to work with parks and everyone else on addressing, having established the baseline of where it's at and what kind of invasives are ruining what part of our natural areas and parks. We're going to have to figure out the strategy for eradicating it. It is really bad, and it makes no sense to go to all this effort to procure additional natural areas, parks, and just have it overtaken by invasives. But the onslaught is unrelenting.
Well, perhaps, hopefully, we can find a good corporate citizen that'll come forward to help us with part of this. And in the challenging times we're in, it may even call for a civilian conservation corps concept to get people into places like
that. I think we're intrigued by that idea, yeah, because, as you said, a lot of this just requires physical labor out there to do the work.
The second issue I wanted just to touch base on has to do with strategies 1 and 5. And particularly the slide that you showed on Mount Tabor, is it middle school?
Middle school.
Yeah. Middle school, and the rain garden. And it reminded me of what I've seen at Astor Elementary School in North Portland, where they have a community water garden, but the same concept. It is a stormwater management plan, but it's also a laboratory for the students.
Exactly.
Elementary and middle schools throughout the city have the same challenge. They've just got lots of blacktop and not enough green. And I'm delighted to hear that there's 30 programs with Portland Public Schools. Just two comments. One is I would think this is a strategy that we'd want to develop and not defer to Portland Public Schools. They are overwhelmed with their core mission, which is the classroom instruction. And I hope that as the mayor-elect leads the Portland plan, I hope it's something that we can take the lead on. And it seems like a unique opportunity for parks and BES and schools to work on this. And one thing, Commissioner Kogan and I were at a elementary school, the Lee School in Outer Southeast a couple weeks ago, and it was interesting. The principal is a school surrounded by blacktop, and then the obligatory soccer field that's in terrible condition attached to it. Biggest problem that he has is getting parents to be involved in the program, in the school. Changing area, hardworking people. He has difficulty getting parents into the school. And on the weekends, the site is not used.
Right.
And it seems like nothing would be more productive in terms of both meeting the stormwater management goals that you've laid out and also building community than to have a water garden or a rain garden or something that the community is then embraces and maintains, which goes to your other issue you raised about
how did
the challenge of building and maintaining and operating. So...
Well, Commissioner, those
depending
are
on where all the bureaus end up, it's something that I am extremely interested in working with you
it's
on.
It's a very good point.
I think since I've been BS commissioner, I've inaugurated 4 or 5 school-based facilities, and it's just a question of resources, not a question of desire. Same with invasives. We use you're right on point. We use prisoners, and work release. It's a question of resources.
The one thing I will say about Astor Elementary School that made it, I think, kind of unique was Walsh Construction came in and actually took up the blacktop. And then they recycled it in paving the new Columbia.
Uh-huh.
Now, they still ended up in the short end of that deal, but it was an example of a true community partnership to help facilitate it.
And let me just be clear on the work we're doing with Portland Public Schools. We haven't said to them that the maintenance of these facilities is your problem. When you figure it out, come talk to us. We are working hand in hand with them. We've actually provided them a grant so they could hire someone for a year to represent their interests in discussions with us on how to best maintain these facilities. So we're working closely with them on this question.
And the final question I had is, the word infiltration is a mouthful. When we're out talking about this in the public, what's the plain English equivalent that we can use that communicates this? Is it just green roads or swales, or is there some concept that's easier to digest than that?
Than an infiltration facility?
Well, it sounds, you showed us a picture of an infiltration facility.
Swale.
It seemed like something a neighborhood might want to oppose and not embrace.
Interesting. Yeah, no.
Swale.
And it's all about absorbing water.
Natural feature.
Yeah, maybe. Mimicking the natural environment. Right. Water coming back into the ground where it falls instead of being put in a pipe and sent away.
Well, we have a lot of them now in Hollywood and Grant Park, thanks to PDOT and to BES. And it's actually, as I wait for my bus in the morning, there's a swale and benches and something going on there. So
good.
It is a great amenity.
The facility formerly known as Infiltration is now swale.
Well, thank you very much for your
support.
Well.
Thank you, folks.
Good work. Good work.
This is a report. I need a motion to accept.
Motion.
Second.
Thank you. Please call the vote.
Adams?
I want to, in addition to thanking the Bureau and all of our nonprofit and private partners, we hustle to get it, in almost every project we do, we always have to hustle to get nonprofit help and private sector assistance as well. And because of that, we're able to stretch the meager dollars a long, long way. So thanks to all of you to helping make sure and your team that that happens. I also want to thank Lisa Libby, who has been absolutely key in getting the Gray to Green project done. Really appreciate your work. It was fantastic. And to the City Council that has been so incredibly supportive over the past 3.5 years. Aye.
Fish.
I want to acknowledge Commissioner Adams' leadership on this and also thank Dean Marriott and his team for superb work. My neighborhood in the Grant Park area is an example of an area that's been enhanced by some of the Greater Green work that you're doing. It seems like this overall initiative is the next key wave here, and I look forward to supporting you as you go forward. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, this is a great report and a lot of specifics. I want to commend Bureau of Environmental Services, Commissioner Adams' office, Lisa Libby for their great work here. Obviously, the very precise metrics you have are a reflection of your commissioner in charge. And they're good, and they're very tangible. And I think that, the whole effort, the whole Greater Green Initiative, I think just the whole idea that we can refinance some of our bonded indebtedness and use that increment to invest in cost-effective stormwater solutions that mimic the natural environment or recreate the natural environment is what people are looking for in this city, and I think what this nation's looking for. But again, I think Portland is way out in front here, and I appreciate the leadership in all this. Please vote aye.
Potter.
I think it's an excellent report. Dean, you and your staff did a great job. Commissioner Adams, thank you for your leadership. Libby. This is the kind of product I think that Portlanders get used to, but they don't see all the work that goes into it and the amount of trying to stretch those dollars, as Commissioner Adams pointed out. Thank you all. I vote aye. Please go to the regular agenda, read item 1633.
Authorize an intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County to fund treatment services and alternatives to prostitution.
This is an intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County, and it's administered through to LifeWorks. It goes to some of the questions that were raised earlier through the folks who came to speak at council regarding prostitution on 82nd. And that I know there's a lot of frustration out in the community with this, but there's also a lot of good work being done by the police bureau as well as the criminal justice system. What this does is provide an alternative to prostitutes, to get them out of their work, provide them housing treatment, and ensure that they have a chance to escape what many consider to be a form of modern-day slavery. So with that, I'd like to call up staff. Prior to that, though, there is an amendment to Exhibit A, and it fixes some typos and other things, but it doesn't really affect the goals or the details of the work. I need a motion to accept the amendment.
So moved. Second.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Commander.
Well, good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Mike Krebs. I'm the commander of East Precinct, and I've been taking the lead for the prostitution problem on the east side of Portland, mostly 82nd Avenue. And with me, next to me to my left, is Kathleen Treb, the Assistant Director of the Department of Community Justice. We've been working together to find ways to give prostitutes some treatment so they can get out of the prostitution business. Back in August, as you heard earlier, the prostitution problem on 82nd Avenue has significantly increased over the last year. And what we did a survey. We wanted to find out why the prostitutes were going to 82nd Avenue, why they were in prostitution. So we did six missions over a 10-day period and then went to a survey as we arrested them. And we asked them, why do they work as a prostitute? And they indicated that money, food, support their family, to support their pimp. So many of these women are compelled to be prostitutes by their pimp. And some of them even made the indication they like to shop. And we found that it runs the gamut of ages from age 13 to 50. And we asked them also where they came from. And many of them said they'd prostituted before in Florida, Hawaii, San Francisco, Seattle, Tacoma. So they were coming from all parts of the country, coming to do prostitution activities here. And we found that we asked them why 82nd Avenue. We said, well, it goes for miles. It's easy picking. It's people drive by all the time. It's easy to get what they refer to as tricks. We also asked them some questions about how did they get into prostitution. And they said that one of them was, my mom was a prostitute, so I became a prostitute. One of them indicated that her stepfather got her into it. Another one said that through addiction. So we found that there's women that were forced into it by a parent, an uncle. And there's a lot of victims out there, and they need some treatment for these individuals. We then asked them the question about what social services could we give you to help you maybe get out of prostitution. They indicated housing, counseling, medical help, and finding a real job. Many of these people have very little life skills. And so a big part of our project was trying to arrest our way out of this problem, and it's not going to happen. And we're here today to ask you for funds to provide treatment for these women. We sent out an RFP, request for proposal for prostitution treatment, and LifeWorks Northwest came to the top. They've been in the business for a lot of years, over 45 years. LifeWorks Northwest been in the business of helping people. Back in the 90s and the early 2000s, they had a program called New Options for Women, and the funding went away. And now we're going to try to refund that and get that started again. And Kathleen Treb, who runs many of the treatment programs with the county, has a lot of experience in not only writing up these contracts with LifeWorks Northwest, but monitoring the contract to make sure they're carrying out what they're supposed to be doing. And one of the big pieces of LifeWorks Northwest and with this contract is they become part of the service coordination team. Down at Central Precinct, they have a coordination team where the police, the district attorney, the treatment program, and the probation officials work together to give individual treatment and help people get off the streets. So I'll let Kathleen speak further about some of the things they've been doing and more about the contract.
Actually, I'll just give you the three objectives that the contract would have. One would be to provide an on-site integrated trauma, mental health, and drug alcohol addiction screening, assessment, and treatment for women and girls. They think the majority will be for adults, to address criminality and reduce recidivism, of course, the outcomes for any criminal justice program, and provide coordinated case management services to reduce barriers to treatment, success, and long-term recovery, including housing, employment, education, and social support. This is what New Options for Women proposes to do. They think people will stay an average of about 9 months you know, this is a very complex program. And I was actually laughing as I was coming over here. I ran into Joanne Fuller, and we've worked together for very long. And we said, you know, we did this with the city in 1985. We funded a program for prostitutes, city and county together. Then, you know, through a lot of budget cuts, things changed, and we stopped. But really the problems have not changed. Maybe how people do it, how you advertise, where you advertise.